Welcome to the 133rd episode of Show Me the Crypto. This episode's a great one. We chatted with Tess Reneerson, who is the head of emerging products with OP Labs. Alf, what were your overall thoughts on this conversation?
That was great. I love talking with someone who's been in the space for a long time. Tess got in super early. I think Bitcoin was in like the low hundreds when she first stumbled upon it and got introduced. And so we talk a bit about her history in crypto, how she got originally interested, and how her then career, because she got right into crypto, like from a career standpoint, how that evolved in the space over the years. She ended up working at Twitter as a crypto engineering lead there. And then moving beyond that to where she is today, working for Optimism at OP Labs, and talking about everything Optimism and Layer 2 and what that ecosystem's all about. There's so much happening in Ethereum and in L2s right now. There was the Dankun upgrade that recently came out that lowered fees on L2s by like 95%+. So we get into a lot of those upgrades, all of those features, and a lot of what the Optimism ecosystem is and where it's going in the future. So we covered a lot in that whole realm, which was super interesting. We don't always get to dive into L2s. So
yeah, and other things Tess touched on was the superchain. So that involves not only OP mainnet, but also Base, also Zora, and talking about kind of what it takes to be part of that super chain, how those other chains are contributing and working together collaboratively. And that's really Tess's history, is this history of interoperability and working with companies that are trying to have this multifaceted, multi-blockchain approach. So really interesting there. She also talked about retroactive goods funding. So Optimism is rewarding those who have already been building within Optimism. That includes creators, all sorts of people. We talk about airdrops. We talk about fault proofs. Today, as of recording, March 19th is when fault proofs have gone live on OP's testnet. So really, really great info-filled conversation with Tess Reneerson.
Show me the crypto. Show me the crypto. Show me the crypto.
In a world on the brink of disruption, two men will bring you clarity by interviewing some of the most intelligent and influential names in the blockchain world. Welcome to Show Me the Crypto with your hosts, Wade Patterson and Ulf Lonnegren.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Show Me the Crypto. My name is Wade Patterson.
And I'm Alf Lonnegren.
We're a couple of friends from Canada who love learning about cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, and we're happy you're along for the ride. Whether you're a crypto virgin or you know your way around the block, we hope our interviews with some of the most intelligent and influential people in the blockchain space help deliver you with value. And on this episode, we're joined by Tess Reneerson, head of emerging products with OP Labs. Tess got into crypto backwards. While most start as hobbyists before migrating their careers to the space, Tess made crypto her career straight away by landing a job with a Bitcoin API company called Chain in 2015. She went on to work with Interstellar, Cosmos, and lead Twitter's crypto team before joining OP Labs in February 2023. Optimism is a collective of companies, communities, and citizens working together to reward public goods and build a sustainable future for Ethereum. Tess, welcome to Show Me the Crypto.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're stoked to have you on. And I want to go back. You were recently at ETH Denver and you were telling a little bit of a story of how you got into crypto as a career and that it was a 4-hour bus ride with Jesse Pollock of Base. So I'm curious, can you take us back to that time when you were kind of on the verge of, am I going to enter this industry? And how did that bus ride change your mind?
Yeah, totally. So it was like January or maybe February 2015. So for context, you know, Bitcoin had gone up, I think the previous year, up to like $1,000, which was, you know, the highest highs, unthinkable number, had crashed really, really hard, you know, was hovering maybe around like $200. And I think there really was this sense of kind of like, is this the end of Bitcoin? You know, like it, like at that point, we'd really only been through one market cycle. Who knew where this stuff was going? And then, you know, personally in my own life and career, I was a couple years into, you know, a couple years post-college. I had been working at Medium, where I was very much a full stack engineer, working on front end, back end, all kinds of stuff. But finding myself more and more drawn towards the back end, towards databases, towards distributed systems. And I was kind of thinking like, okay, how do I go deeper on this kind of thing? Like, what are some of the interesting problems? You know, again, very much from like an engineering perspective, not from like a business perspective or even like a user perspective, but I was just like, what's happening in the world that's like interesting with this stuff? And so I started talking to a company, which is called Chain, because, you know, in 2015, you could have a company called Chain. they had chain.com and everything, you know, again, like hard to imagine starting something like that today, but, you know, again, a different era. In fact, recently I found some old blog posts from the company at that time, and we spelled the word blockchain with a space in the middle. So that's like, again, just to really orient you in the way that we were kind of thinking about this stuff. It was very early. But again, you know, tons of uncertainty around Bitcoin, Ethereum. I think the white paper had been written, but it hadn't launched yet. So really it was just sort of Bitcoin and like the very first altcoins like Litecoin that were Bitcoin forks. And so I was like, you know, this stuff is cool. I think I understand how it works. It seems like an interesting problem. You know, is there anything there? And I ended up sitting next to Jesse, who I'd been friends with for a couple of years at that point, on sort of this big group trip from San Francisco up to Tahoe. And so we were on this, you know, again, like four hour bus ride. And I think Jesse joked like, yeah, like they like locked me in a room with him effectively. And he just talked my ear off about Bitcoin and what was interesting, what was exciting, and, you know, told me a little bit more about some of the underlying technical stuff as well, which I, you know, was still sort of getting into at that point. And by the end of the bus ride, actually, I was also then like turning around and like telling other people on the bus about it because people were like overhearing it and they had questions. And then I was sort of getting into it too. And so by the time, you know, by the time we were in Tahoe, I really was like, okay, I'm like pretty interested in this stuff. Like, you know, I should probably go work at that Bitcoin company. And then Chain, you know, pivoted a couple of times, explored a bunch of different ideas in the space, definitely went through the whole blockchain, not Bitcoin era of like 2016, 2017, worked on some enterprise stuff. So again, I definitely got to see some interesting things and some interesting uses of the technology.
And you were also the crypto engineering lead at Twitter at one point. Tell us about that role. What did that, you know, what does that title actually entail when it comes to a job? And what was that experience like working at Twitter?
Yeah, that is a great question. It is very funny because, you know, I went to Twitter in like the end of 2021. And so at that point I'd been in crypto for about 6 years, almost 7 years. And, you know, crypto is like a wild space, like a lot of great stuff happens in the crypto space, and a lot of like weird stuff happens too. Right. And so when I went to Twitter, I was like, this is going to be like my big girl job. Like, this is my adult job. It's going to be totally calm, stable. We're going to like ship a lot of products to like real people and like normal users. And then a certain somebody showed up and bought the company. And so it was definitely not, you know, what I thought it was going to be when I went in there. But it was, you know, my role really was to be, to try to figure out what Twitter could be doing with crypto, right? So some of that stuff was fairly tangible. Like we shipped NFT profile pictures as sort of an experiment with, you know, starting to do some stuff on chain. But then also trying to connect that back into creator monetization and understanding what that could do for, you know, Twitter's creator community. And then, you know, turned my attention and my very small team's attention towards some longer term bets as well, and starting to think more about, you know, what Twitter could really do that would lead to more decentralization and more on-chain stuff. And unfortunately, I will say, you know, I think my team's approach was very much like a lot of people in crypto, was sort of interested in like a like incremental decentralization, right? Where it's like, okay, the world we're in today, very centralized. That's what people are comfortable with and interested in. But we really want to move towards this world with a lot of decentralization, where users have a lot of control, a lot of sovereignty, can really consent to, you know, what they're doing and how their stuff is being used and how their identity is portrayed. And unfortunately, with, you know, the management change and the leadership shift, there was much less interest in that part of crypto. And so when that happened, I was like, you know what? Value's not really aligning for me at this point. And that was when I started looking around and decided to join Optimism.
What are the interesting things looking throughout your career, whether it was, you know, Interstellar, Cosmos, is that interoperability seems to be kind of a key theme or a key belief of a lot of those companies. I'm curious for you, is that something like right from the get-go when you got introduced to the space, was that something that made perfect sense? Like in a space where at times maximalism tends to be a bit of a narrative, were you always kind of the mind of, you know, it needs to be an interoperable future?
No, that's definitely something that I grew into and came to realize over time. So, you know, the first company I worked at, I wouldn't quite go so far to say that it was like Bitcoin maxis. And obviously, like, we experimented with a lot of different kinds of crypto projects and blockchain projects, but they're definitely, you know, it came out of a very Bitcoin-centric mentality. And, you know, to this day, there's like tons of things that I really love about Bitcoin and think Bitcoin has gotten exactly right and just like really respect about Bitcoin and the ecosystem around it. But, you know, one of the things that I really realized, and this kind of goes back to my engineering background too, right? Like, there isn't a single database that everyone uses for everything. And I don't even mean like a single instantiation of a database. I mean like a single kind of database, right? You have key value stores, you have SQL databases, you replicate them and scale them and shard them in all these different ways. And it really ends up being so tailored to your use case and what you're doing. And so at some point I was like, why would a blockchain be any different? Like, you know, I have sort of always, you know, even from that day on the bus, in a lot of ways, I've always just thought of blockchains as databases that have very specific properties and make very specific trade-offs. And so when I looked at it that way, I was like, oh, it's so obvious that you're going to have, you know, different approaches to this technology, different products that just make different trade-offs for different use cases and different users.
So the timing of this conversation is interesting because we're about 1 week after the Denkun upgrade. And so I'm curious to start off with Optimism. Like, what was the immediate impact for the OP mainnet that was seen once Denkun went live?
Yeah, so Denkun, huge. The important thing about Denkun is that it activated a specific EIP, Ethereum Improvement Proposal, called 4844. Which changed the way that L2s write their data back to L1. So something that people might not realize, and actually I didn't realize until I started working in the L2 space, is that historically, traditionally, L2s actually write all of their transaction data to L1. They don't execute it all on L1, of course, because then you just sort of replicate the whole system, but or you wouldn't get any advantage from having the L2. But they actually, you know, you can actually replicate the whole state or you could replay all the transactions and get to the end state just from the transactions that are also stored on L1. And this is really expensive, right? And that's one of the reasons why gas fees on L2s have, you know, hovered around 30 cents, 40 cents, 50 cents, has been just the cost of storing all that stuff back on L1. And so what EIP 4844 does is it changes the place that data is stored from the call data in Ethereum transactions to something called a blob storage. So when people talk about blobs, you know, we say we love the blobs. we're talking about, you know, moving all this stuff into blob storage, which is just much cheaper and more effective or more efficient. So that's really what 4844 is about. That's what Denkun is about. It has been a long time coming. Engineers on the Optimism team had been working with engineers at other rollups and other parts of the Ethereum ecosystem, including a bunch of folks at Base, actually. This is one of, in some ways, was the start of the collaboration between Optimism and Coinbase, is actually around 4844 and really trying to bring these fees down. So, and that started about 2 years ago. So, again, long time coming, just activated last week, March 13th or 14th. And we have seen just such an enormous reduction in fees. So again, previously the median transaction fee depended a little bit on congestion, but it would hover around 30, 40, 50 cents, something like that. Since we're activated, we have seen transaction fees that are lower than a cent, like a tenth of a cent, two tenths of a cent, just an enormous, enormous reduction in fees. And, you know, I will say that there have been some expectations that the fees will go back up, right? As the fees lower, that creates more demand potentially for, or, you know, that might drive more usage as the fees go down. And then more usage leads to more demand for block space. More demand for block space could lead to more congestion, could lead back to higher fees. So there is kind of this, there's been a little bit of an unknown about where fees will land ultimately, but you know, we're a week in and we're still seeing fees that are very, very low. So that suggests that they're not going to start like shooting up again anytime soon.
Yeah, that's super exciting, I'm sure, for builders, users, everyone who fees impact, right? That's a major substantial drop. So I think a lot of people were looking forward to this, and it's great to see the fees actually come down like as much as they have. But before we get too far into any specific features or, you know, aspects of layer twos and Optimism, I want to take a step back. And for those who maybe aren't as familiar, can you just explain what is Optimism? You know, what is the OP mainnet versus the other Optimism products? And maybe a bit of just history on where Optimism started to where they are today and what that all entails.
Yeah, totally. So you mentioned a couple different like entities or concepts here. One is Optimism itself. One is OP mainnet. And then you didn't mention, but I think it's sometimes it's implied also, is the super chain, right? And the collection of all of the other chains that are sort of in the Optimism ecosystem. So to start, Optimism is a collective of teams, companies, projects that are committed to building together and scaling Ethereum. So we do that mostly through the OP stack, which is the code base that powers OP mainnet, which I'll talk about in a second, and all the other OP chains. But we also do that through things like RPGF, which is retroactive public goods funding, which is a experiment in public goods funding and governance where our community votes on which projects in the Ethereum and Optimism ecosystems have had the most impact and which should receive funding retroactively for the work that they've done. So one thing that can be challenging, right, when we talk about like doing grants and building open source ecosystems, it can be figuring out who to fund and what to fund up front. And so RPGF kind of flips this around and says, okay, what if we fund people based on the impact that they've had retroactively and the things that they've done retroactively so we can really measure, improve, prove their impact out. So, you know, those are a couple of different aspects and elements of the Optimism Collective. But again, it's really about scaling Ethereum and then building public goods. Okay, so that's Optimism. Okay. OP mainnet is the specific L2 that is built on the OP stack that is sort of like the home base for a lot of what happens on Optimism. So Optimism governance happens on OP mainnet, and it's actually also was the first OP chain. OP chains are any of the chains that are running OP stack software. And then finally, the superchain is a network of OP chains, you know, that share this common rollup architecture. They're built on the OP stack, but then they also commit to contributing sequencer revenue. So basically the revenue that they make from their users transacting on chain, they contribute that sequencer revenue back into the Optimism Collective, which then gets dispersed through RPGF and you know, grants mechanisms and things like that. So in a lot of ways, it's like a bunch of chains coming together to say, hey, we're going to build something that is bigger than any of us could build on our own. We're going to invest in our future together. We're going to invest in shared infrastructure. And so it's this really, you know, that's why we call it a collective, which I think some people think is a little bit of a cheesy term, but I think it really is apt and accurate in this case. It's a group of projects, teams, chains that are all coming together to build something together.
We recently had an interview where, you know, we were talking a lot about the Dane Kuhn upgrade. We were talking about L2s. And I think an interesting conversation is around like, how do we actually get users using L2s? And I think if you're in the space and you're reasonably heavy Ethereum user, that conversation might be irrelevant to you because you're using L2s. It's just normal. It's your day in, day out. You know, gas is cheap. It just makes sense, right? It's the good life. But if you're somewhat new to crypto, or even not necessarily new, but let's just say not as active, like maybe you've been in crypto for years, but you don't actually do a lot in it, you know, aside from coming in once in a while to buy some new coins that you're interested in or something along those lines, or maybe you've only really, maybe you're heavy in the NFT side and you don't do a lot else, you know, that's you're sort of more on the collector side. You might have only experienced world in the L1s, right? You might have just been working on Ethereum when you do your transactions or when you buy your NFTs. And for those people, they're not even familiar with like, how do I even get to an L2? Like, well, it's hard enough to understand sometimes, like, what is the purpose of an L2? But also, how do I, like, I don't have an L2, you know, wallet right now. And how do I go use the L2? So this is kind of like a high level question. But, you know, what will it take to get the other majority of users who aren't so, you know, active in the space over to L2s? And this does tie to that question around NFTs too, because NFTs right now, all the big ones and therefore lots of new ones still launch on Ethereum layer one right now. So what's it going to take to get everyone over to L2s one day where life is just better?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such a great question. And, you know, the first thing I want to say is like, this does not feel like a moot question to me at all. Very much when I was at Twitter, I could see, you know, the ways in which this very diverse, very complex multi-chain ecosystem that, you know, the crypto natives and crypto native community is really moving towards, that is very confusing and not very resonant for a lot of people who, you know, did not sort of come up in the space, right? When we launched the NFT profile picture feature at Twitter, the by far the most common support request was, hey, I connected my wallet and I don't see my NFT. Like, it's gone or it's missing. And the reason for that, you know, the NFT was not missing. It was not gone. But there were two reasons why this might happen. The first was that often the NFT was on another blockchain, right? Twitter decided to support Ethereum L1 as the only blockchain right off the bat, right out of the box, because that's where, you know, the majority of like NFT volume was and where the majority of the NFT community seemed to be, especially at the time, which again was like end of 2021. So people didn't, like most people didn't know that if you have a Solana NFT, that's not, you know, going to show up in your Ethereum wallet. And part of that, right, is like we have like the internet, which is like a single thing. There's only the internet. And sometimes, you know, in the media or, you know, even within the industry, people will talk about like the blockchain as if that is also like a single entity concept. And it's really not, right? Like it's this much more sort of complex and fragmented thing that's happening under the surface. So that was one problem. And then the other problem was that because minting NFTs on L1 was so expensive, a lot of the cost saving measures that companies would come up with or products would come up with would try to circumvent that in some way, but then again, add more complexity. So the other reason why NFTs sometimes wouldn't show up in someone's wallet would be that they had done what's called lazy minting on an exchange like OpenSea, where you could instantiate your NFT data structure, but then not actually put it on chain. So they sort of have this NFT, you know, object that was like in the OpenSea database, but not actually on the Ethereum blockchain. And the reason for that, right, is putting it on chain on L1 is really expensive. But again, just like a very confusing system. If you don't know how blockchains work or why it's so expensive to do different things or, you know, how you allocate storage space on chain, like most people should not have to think about that stuff. So I think the very first thing is, you know, just we're going to get there, but it's going to be an evolution of better abstractions around blockchains for end users. And so even when we talk about interoperability, in a lot of ways, what we're really talking about is abstracting the concept that you have multiple chains and sort of putting some kind of, you know, box around that, an abstraction layer around that, that lets users interact with them in a way that's more seamless and sort of feels like it's one chain. And so one thing that we're doing with Optimism and the Superchain is working on native interoperability, which is a building block that applications and devs will be able to use to create experiences that feel more like that. So that's one thing. The other thing that I think will be really, really important for L2 adoption is cost. And so this goes back to things like 4844. But I think one of the other like paradigm shifts from Web 2 to Web 3 is this idea of like who pays for the compute. So in Web 2, when you're a developer and you launch a project, by default, you're paying, you know, for the compute that your users are using and generating. This means that you have to go out and figure out some way to monetize it. You have to, you know, charge your users a subscription fee, or you have to, you know, monetize their attention and their eyeballs somehow. So that's like a double-edged sword, obviously. One thing that's cool about Web3 is that it gives us this alternative of letting users pay gas fees, which are like, you know, paying for their compute incrementally as they use it. So there's sort of this cool like option there, but today, that is typically the only option for a lot of on-chain applications. And as we try to get more people, you know, from Web2 on-chain and experimenting with on-chain apps, we're going to need to provide that option for developers to cover their users' gas costs and maybe experiment with some of those more Web2 type models. And so just getting those gas costs down low enough that developers can front them up front is going to be a really important part of that story as well.
Tess, so I'm curious about, you mentioned there the super chain and just diving into that a little bit more. So Base is a part of that, Zora. Mm-hmm. Who else is part of the super chain? And what's that process? I mean, does Optimism kind of actively go out seeking others to be part of this, or how do those collaborations take place?
Yeah, so I believe most of the chains that come and join the super chain do approach us. And right now it is, you know, there is a, it's not like an automated system where you can just like launch a chain and it automatically becomes part of the super chain. We will probably get to that point at some point. But right now, you know, as the super chain is fairly small, and we have, you know, pretty high touch relationships with most of our customers. You know, those teams really do come to us and we have regular conversations with them. And then I mentioned this earlier, but the other piece of being part of the super chain is that rev share and that commitment to reinvesting in the collective and the infrastructure that powers it. So for all of those reasons, it's, you know, teams, it's a long ongoing conversation with these teams. And, you know, it's really a conversation that we want to have keep going, right? Like we learn a lot from these customers as they launch their chains, as they grow their ecosystems, as they build things out about, you know, what they need, what their users need, and things like that.
We've talked a lot today about the Dankun upgrade and lowering fees basically on L2s and the importance of that. But there is a lot more on the Ethereum roadmap and other improvement proposals and features that at some point will come to continue to not only lower fees, but offer other capabilities and other features that will benefit Optimism and layer twos. Can you explain what maybe some of those things are, some things that maybe you're looking forward to in the future, or some things that you just know need to continue to be worked on as a focal point?
Yeah, I won't name any specific upgrades, but I will say that, you know, one of the things that we view as really important for Optimism and for OP chains is maintaining a really, really high level of compatibility with the EVM and staying as close to the EVM that's on L1 as possible. You know, a big part of this insistence on sort of that level of homogeneity comes from the fact that we want to provide really consistent experiences for developers, right? I know this sounds like a tangent from the EIP question, but I'll come back to it. The thing is, if you're a developer and you're doing, you know, cross-chain applications, you want to know that the environment and the tools that you're building with on both sides of that transaction are going to be as similar as possible. So that's sort of, there's sort of a trade-off here, right? Between like the level of customization that we encourage people to do out of the box so that they can still have sort of this cohesive and positive developer experience for the developers that are building on their chains. And so for this reason, the changes that come in to L1 and to the EVM on L1 are really important, and we track them pretty carefully. And we, you know, really want to see some of the EIPs that our customers have been requesting either land on L1 or get adopted pretty uniformly by L2s through things like, there's a process called roll call, which is kind of like EIPs, but for L2s specifically. Standardization efforts like that are really important, again, to sort of maintain that consistent positive experience for developers. So one example of an EIP that customers have been asking for that will, I think, unlock a lot of really interesting stuff is EIP 7212, which adds a precompile for certain kinds of elliptic curve cryptography, which probably sounds really arcane, but basically it lets developers access certain elliptic curve mechanisms, certain cryptography libraries, in a very native way on chain. And what that unlocks is a lot of different authentication mechanisms. It lets you build in like passkey type stuff and sort of more, for better or worse, sometimes you call it more like Web 2 like login experiences for on-chain apps. So that's an example of something that is like, again, sounds pretty arcane, but actually has these like really big end user experience improvements at the end of that pipeline.
One of the things you've talked about is the retroactive goods funding. And I'm just curious, like getting the airdrop mechanism correct and how that rewards, like what goes into that? Because I can only imagine there was one point I was fortunate enough, one of my wallets, I received one of the first Optimism airdrops. It's a nice surprise. And I went into the Discord months later after I'd claimed mine, and just the people complaining about, because I think there was a little pause and like how like long they could access it. And they're like, why haven't I, you know, Optimism stealing this? And people, you know, the Optimism team was responding, you had a year to claim this, like, don't worry, it's coming back. We just need a minute kind of thing. And of course that was all sorted out, but like, it just seems like it would be tricky. Like what goes into these decisions, the decision-making of kind of who gets rewarded, how, you know, what is valid for rewards?
Yeah. So first things first, there's sort of two separate concepts here, right? Mm. One is RPGF, that retroactive public goods funding, and the other is airdrops. And RPGF is really driven by the Optimism community, right? So there is a process by which applications apply. It's an open, or teams apply. It's an open application process. And then, you know, Optimism badge holders who we sort of view as like the citizens of the Optimism community, you know, go out and vote on how that funding should be allocated. So that's RPGF, you know, again, very much decided by the community. Then there's airdrops. And that is really driven by the Optimism Foundation. And I actually don't work at the Optimism Foundation. I work at OP Labs, which is like the protocol development company. So I am not so hands-on with, you know, making any kind of decision around airdrops, or I should say I'm not hands-on at all with that. It's, you know, I learn about airdrops often the same time that everyone else does.
Right.
That said, I know that the intention there is really to, you know, reward the people who are building out the ecosystem and making it a really vibrant place and turning the superchain into the kind of ecosystem that we want to see. So for example, the most recent airdrop targeted NFT creators. And it wasn't just for OP Mainnet, it was for all of the chains that have NFT ecosystems in the superchain. So Base and Zora creators were also eligible for this airdrop, also received tokens because, again, we really view them, or, you know, the Optimism Foundation really views them as contributors and people who are making the Optimism ecosystem and the superchain the kind of place that we want it to be.
So Tess, one thing I wanted to ask about, which is another sort of maybe bigger question and perhaps something that doesn't totally fit within what, you know, you represent because it goes beyond Optimism. But speaking to L2s more as a whole, and again, maybe for our audience who doesn't fully, grasp all the differences and reasons behind L2s. There's been a lot of evolution over the last, couple of years. I mean, everything moves fast in crypto, but, with L2 specifically, there was like optimistic rollups. There's now ZK rollups. There's these different layer two technologies. And you see now these different layer two chains that continue to exist with using different layer two sort of approaches. Why is that? What is optimism's sort of viewpoint on that or direction? And how do you think that will play out in the future between all these different layer twos?
Yeah, totally. So, I mentioned earlier that I had sort of come to this understanding that like interoperability was important because you needed to have different approaches to solving these problems that would make different trade-offs. And I think that, the sort of type of rollup that you have or the type of proofs that you use to secure your rollup today is a good example of, making a technical trade-off that, might impact the way that you go to market or the way that your users use it and the trade-offs that they're making. That said, I think, the optimistic, the fault proof system is sort of like a incentive-based shortcut in a lot of ways that like is one of many different kinds of proofs that you can use to secure a rollup. And even though we, have optimism in our name and, launched the first optimistic rollup, optimism in OP Labs is not, we're not like fault-proof maxis. You know what I mean? Like we really do view this as a situation where, a chain can incorporate lots of different proofs and actually ideally have a redundant proof system. So that if one of the proofs has a bug or fails in some way, you can fall back onto these other proof systems that, are not only different implementations, but have totally different specs and actually rely on different, mechanisms and designs to secure that rollup.
Our previous guest was Anthony Sassano, and you mentioned fault proofs there. We wanted Anthony to give us a question to ask you. So this was going back about a week ago, and he said, I'm going to give you a spicy question. Ask Tess about fault proofs, when fault proofs, and slightly less spicy now, I guess, because there's been a recent announcement. We're recording this as of March 19th. Can you give us a little bit more info on where fault proofs are at?
Yeah, totally. So definitely that has been a spicy question historically. It's been a hard problem. It's been something that we've been working on for a long time. But today actually is the day for fault proofs on testnet. Awesome. So we are launching fully, got to really clarify the on testnet piece. That's important. But these are, the fully featured fault proofs that have everything that you would need. They're feature complete, they're permissionless, which means that anyone will be able to initiate a withdrawal and get their ETH or get their ERC-20 tokens out, without relying on a trusted third party, without relying on, a single entity anywhere in there. And it also means that anyone can challenge withdrawal. So if someone is monitoring the chain and they see that a withdrawal has been initiated and they think it's invalid for some reason, they can challenge that as well. So it really adds a lot of robustness to our system. The other thing that we're doing as part of this launch, this testnet launch, is that we're really rolling out a framework for fault proofs that lets other teams plug in their own proof systems. Which again goes back to this idea that you really want redundancy there and you want different kinds of proofs. So we're partnering with two fantastic ZK teams. We're working with the Risk Zero team to do a fault proof implementation that's ZK based. And then we're also working with O(1) Labs to do a different kind of proof implementation, but that also uses ZK tech. So we're, parallelizing a lot of stuff. We're really trying to move into that multi-proof world where you have that redundancy. And just to zoom out for a second and to talk a little bit more about that redundancy and why it matters, you might be familiar with the rollup decentralization framework. Someone goes to L2Beat, sees all the rollups, they'll see, which rollups are at which stage of decentralization. And, generally as you progress through there's three stages, stage zero, stage one, and stage two. And generally, as you progress through that, you get, you know, better security guarantees for your users. And really what we care about is getting to stage two, right? Like that is the goal for us. Stage two is the point at which there is, you know, you really have full control as a user. Stage one rollups have an override mechanism where some group of people, if something goes wrong, they can sort of revert transactions or sort of get things back into a good state. And the reason you have this override mechanism, right, is because you don't know if there might be a bug or some other problem in your proof system. So if you can get multiple implementations of something, then you can have confidence that, you know, even if something is wrong with one of them, you can fall back onto the other proof systems. And that is really what you need to get to stage two. And so that's also, you know, one of the reasons why the OP team has been working for such a long time on our proof system is, you know, really making something that is very modular that different teams can plug into. Again, because that goal has always been to get to stage two and have this really diverse set of proof systems.
So the testnet live today, is there any sort of timeline on when that would be brought to mainnet or how does that decision get made?
I think our engineering team would probably murder me if I made any promises about mainnet. So I'll zip my lips on that one. But yeah, definitely that's the next step, right? Getting the stuff on mainnet. Is the next step. We want to take time to get it right. We want to put the testnet implementation through its paces, do the right level of security testing, audits, bug bounties, all of that good stuff, just to get it as rock solid as possible. But yeah, full steam ahead towards mainnet.
We're at an interesting point now in the crypto where, I mean, it's always moved fast, but it feels like there's a lot evolving simultaneously right now. There's a lot of different aspects, especially when we talk about Ethereum specifically. Where do you see us in sort of like the long game to mass crypto adoption? And where do you think, like, where do you think we'll be in even just a couple of years as far as what that looks like and maybe how it's going to play out specifically for Optimism as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are going to move towards this world where we have lots of different OP chains. I mean, we'll have lots of different blockchains in general. I've never been, aside from my, you know, very early part of my crypto career where I was had some Bitcoin maximalist tendencies. Post that, I've never been a maximalist, right? I really think that there's a lot of value in having a lot of diversity in the space. So I think we're really moving, we'll move towards a world where there's just more and more stuff happening on chain, more chains that are really optimized ecosystems for the applications that they're supporting. I think that's one of the things that's really exciting about sort of like the app chain thesis in general is this idea that you can really curate the right environment and make the right trade-offs for your developers. And then, yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier, but I think moving, you know, the fact that we're getting costs down so much really means that we're able to build more user experiences that will be on chain and have the benefits of being on chain without people necessarily, you know, feeling the trade-offs or the burdens. So those are some of the things that I'm, you know, very excited about. And I think we'll be seeing, especially in the sort of broader Ethereum space.
Tess, we like to end every episode of Show Me the Crypto with the same three questions we ask every single guest. We're going to get there in a second, but before that, I'm curious because you recently had a title change at OP Labs. You went from head of product to head of emerging products. So what's the biggest difference in the new role?
Yeah, so I'm 2 days into my new role, or like a day and a half into my new role. But what this really means is that I'm going to be focusing on working with the teams that are trying to do like the really novel and like sometimes weird stuff with the OP stack. So I'll be focusing on teams that have forked the OP stack. You know, they're plugging in their own technology and their own stuff. And that that really is going to be my focus area moving forward. So I really enjoyed being, you know, I was the head of product for sort of the whole product team and the whole organization for a while. I really enjoyed that role, but I'm also really excited to go really, really deep with a smaller set of users and also just like figure out what we could be doing on chain. Like what's new, what's weird, what's different. You know, I've been in the space for several years and I'm just like very excited to see what people are doing. That's totally new and novel.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, as I mentioned, we like to ask the same three questions to every single guest. It's a segment we call You Had Me at Crypto. Ulf is going to ask you those questions.
All right. The first question is, who is your favorite person to follow in the crypto space?
So I have had the same favorite shitposter adjacent on Twitter for a while, who's Niraj from Coin Center. I think he just toes the line perfectly of understanding the space so well, calling us out on our shit, but just in a way that's very, very funny and pointed. And he also actually is it was through him or through a message he sent me, which is the first way that I even learned that Elon was involved in Twitter at all. I checked my phone. I had a DM from Niraj that said, "Congrats on your upcoming Doge integration." And I was what is this guy talking about? And then of course I checked the timeline, saw what was going on, and I was oh. So I think he's just a very funny follow. On a more serious note, actually, I think someone who people in the crypto space should be following is Molly White, who runs Web3 Is Going Great. So obviously she's a crypto critic, but I think she's a phenomenal archivist, right? Of everything that's happened in the space, all the stuff we've messed up. And it's just a phenomenal record of where we've been and how we need to do better. So, a little bit of a more sober note maybe, but, I think she's a fantastic follow as well.
That's cool. I'll have to check her out. Yeah. Sounds interesting. All right. Second question. What will the price of Bitcoin be 10 years from now?
No one should ever ask me this question because I have just the worst track record of predicting the Bitcoin price. So I mentioned at the start of our conversation that I got into crypto in 2015. Bitcoin was about $200. I bought some Bitcoin. Then Bitcoin went up. It went all the way up to $400. And I sold it all. I thought, it's doubled. What more could you ask for? I will stay far away from any Bitcoin price speculation because I've proven myself to be an untrustworthy source. I'll put it that way.
Well, lucky for you, on our show, everyone who answers this is an untrustworthy source. We're going out 10 years. There is no right answer. Everybody's wrong. So we'll preface with that. And you can throw any number you want because we know it's not right.
I will not. This is a principle. I cannot. I'm sorry.
That's a line respectful. I cannot cross.
All right.
The average answer is $1 million. That's the most common one. So just nod or blink twice. No, I'm just kidding. That's okay. You can. We'll give you a pass on this one.
Yeah. All right. The third and final question. What is the most underrated project in the crypto space?
Yeah. So I think, a lot of the stuff that I think about and Optimism thinks about and, I get very excited about are on-chain applications, right? Which is on-chain compute, which is this huge swath of space and things you can be doing. But at the end of the day, I am really, really bullish on crypto and blockchains as a mechanism for moving money, right? Yes, store of value, but actually just moving funds around, doing it in a way that is trustless, in a way that handles multiple currencies and cross-border stuff really well. I'm American. I think a lot of my fellow Americans kind of underappreciate how hard it is to move money because across currencies and across borders. And crypto is just awesome for doing that. So some of the projects that are just building better end user experiences for moving money around, I think are some of the things that are most promising, but also just underrated and underappreciated right now. So one that's in the Optimism space is a project called Daimo, D-A-I-M-O, which is just peer-to-peer payments built on Base, lets you send USDC fast, very cheap, permissionless. It's awesome. And I think we don't, appreciate how amazing it is that we can do stuff like that enough.
Awesome. Tess, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you for joining Ulf and I on this episode of Show Me the Crypto.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Thank you for listening to Show Me the Crypto. please make sure to subscribe as well as rate and review this podcast.